Last week, we considered the mysterious chemistries of sensory perception, and now we must try to examine the nature of the self that thinks. When we use this term, the self that thinks, we say it this way because most persons are convinced that the thinker in themselves is themselves. This identification of the being with its own mental processes has disturbed philosophy for a very long time and is beginning to disturb modern psychology. In the modern point of view, the future of man is rather dismal if his salvation depends entirely on his own mind. It is obvious that whatever this mind may be, it is not infallible, that it is not capable of with certainty an inevitable correctness approaching any situation. The mind is not an independent solver of problems. From it comes no infallible revelation about things to be done or changes to be made in human conduct. Rather, the mind seems to be a rather doddering factor. One minute strong for right, and the next strong for weakness. In some way, society as we know it, this vast, confused hodgepodge of individuals, nations, races, cultural systems, religions, political theories, is the projection together of mind. Therefore, if we want to understand the mind, we may as well look not only within us, but around us. For it is the reason for the infinite disagreement. It is the reason for all the self-pity, for all the quick accusations against others. It sustains the countless intemperances which burden and afflict us. And it is forever seeking ways of self-justification, not only wrong, but determined to force that wrong upon itself and upon others. Therefore, while the mind certainly reposes somewhere within the interiorness of ourselves and is not part of our visible constitution, it is forever influencing the visible part of us. It affects our styles and our clothing. It affects our health. It ties us to most extraordinary and unreasonable occupations. It burdens us with pride, tears us down with grief, and continues to operate more or less with or without our consent. I've talked to many persons who were developing what might be termed in the old days mental miseries. Now you ask these people, do you want to be miserable? Are you enjoying this process of intellectually flagellating yourself? Do you choose unhappiness as your pattern for life? Most of these folks will say no, that they really want to be happy, but they feel like being miserable, so they are miserable. It seems as though the very nature of the mind is such that it refuses to rescue the person from the clutches of its own intensities. What have we to fight mind with except mind? How can we diagnose our thoughts except by thinking? How can we examine our knowledge without using our various mental faculties for this very examination? It looks, therefore, in many cases, as though the judge is bribed and the jury corrupted. There seems to be no sense of escape from the tyranny of a faculty which occupies all the important seats in the cabinet of our executive government. We find everywhere notions carried along with splendid fervor and principles perishing from disregard. Our philosophic friends, therefore, tried to think through the problem of how the mind operates and why it is such an unmitigated nuisance in so many careers. We can only assume that the mind, like almost any other part of the personality, is an instrument incomplete, imperfect, unfinished. That to expect maturity of the mind is to expect maturity of a child. Simply because the body has reached what might be considered an age of discretion, we expect the person to be discreet, but he may very well lack the ability to meet these expectations. We have to recognize that the mind itself is a structure that does not automatically accomplish any good thing. Automatically does not accomplish any evil thing. The mind is an instrument, a tool, like a workman's hammer, or his plane, or his saw, or his chisel. It depends upon the workman and how he uses these instruments, whether his work is well done or not well done. The skill is not in the instrument, but in the master who uses it. And in man, the power of the mind is not merely in the faculties themselves, but in some restraint over and above those faculties. Some means of bringing this mental instrument into harmony and order. Last week we were discussing the mental coordinator, and I had a letter a few days ago asking me who he was. Now, I probably was a little lax in not giving a clearer definition of the usage in that particular case, but we have discussed it so much in recent years, I overlooked this need. But the mental coordinator is simply this sixth instrument of the machine of the senses. The mental coordinator is the power which brings phenomena together, organizes it, and sets up relationships between things which, in their unrelated state, contribute no insight or understanding to the individual. This mental coordinator is consequently the power to estimate the findings of various sensory perceptions, reconcile them, discover their consistencies and their inconsistencies, and if necessary, make up for the deficiencies of some faculty which may be impaired. In various ways, this coordinator, therefore, merely summarizes the immediate reflexes of man's perceptions to the stimuli of environment. The coordinator, however, seemingly exercises this additional power. It gradually takes on the appearance of being a thinker. Now, this might not be so dangerous if we understood the true meaning of the word thinker. But we like to assume that this is some kind of a superior mental genius, a person with a vast reputation for erudition, is referred to as a thinker. This should imply that he is sober, deep in his consideration of things, adequate in his experience to weigh, estimate, and measure the validity of report. It is also assumed that the thinker is moved by some deep principles within himself to think nobly and to gradually recover from the phenomena of nature some concept of the universal plan to which this phenomena bears witness. The thinker, therefore, is a person who can answer the question, what does the universe mean to me? At least even reach out toward the opposing concept. What do I mean to the universe? Actually, however, we are not quite sure in practice just what this thinking process accomplishes. For example, what do we think? What is the process by which we stimulate ideas in the mind? Experiments have indicated that this coordinator, this thinker within ourselves, largely thinks in terms of words. In the German, the mental coordinator is a German, speaking the German language. Perhaps High German or Low German, or one of the dialects, according to the district from which it comes. This same mental coordinator may be Spanish, if the body is Spanish. It will think in the Spanish language. And one of the tests that comes to one who is studying a foreign language is when, after considerable effort and time, and perhaps a great deal of patience, the student of language suddenly discovers that he is able to think in the terms of the new language he is seeking to understand. The moment he can think in that language, he possesses it. The moment he can think in it, he can bring the various necessary words of conversation into the forepart of his consciousness at will. But until he thinks in the language, he hesitates, he falters, and he has none of that assurance or insight into the psychological values that accompany the different languages of the world. So when we think of God, what do we really think about? Do we have any clear insight as to the nature of divine being? Or are we thinking G-O-D? When we think in terms of a tree, and we ask ourselves, what is a tree? Almost certainly this coordinator produces a series of words, synonyms or neosynonyms, numerous or scant according to our own possession of vocabulary. When we ask a person, what color is this tree? He says, green. Now, this is simply because green is available to him. He knows no more about the tree than he did before. So what we call thinking very largely is a transmission of certain common observations by means of a common language. We have no assurance at all that the thinking process instinctively seeks any real solution to anything. It merely substitutes one group of words for another. And when we are confronted with problems, we meet them with words. We meet them with words that are not solutional of anything in themselves. We go for help to someone else. He gives us good advice. This advice is given in words. It is accepted into our own mental coordinator as words. It remains there as words. And perhaps at some future time we cheerfully give these words on as priceless advice to somebody else. But in the interval, we have not done anything much with them ourselves. They are simply words. Whether these words be written or spoken, they would imply that the word concept, the language concept, actually is rooted in the mental life of the individual. Therefore, that in this mental life, he belongs to the same kind of world that he belongs to physically. How then shall we attempt to understand how the mind has gained its peculiar authority in the direction of our living? Remember, the mind is in the position to accept, compare all kinds of phenomenal material. The mind also has a further ability within itself, arising from its own very nature, and that is that it can project its own conclusions in strict harmony with traditional experience or observation, but not beyond. Thus it may happen that the mind can perform certain useful functions. Supposing we stand two objects side by side on a table. One is a large melon and the other is a small melon. We immediately turn our attention upon the problems suggested by the presence of a melon. The most simple, natural, inevitable process would be to attend to one melon and say, this is a melon. Attend to the other melon and say, this is a melon. And consider the deal closed. But we don't do that. The moment there are two melons, something happens. Instinctively, without realizing it or without knowing why we do it, we come to certain conclusions about our two melons. Somewhere arises within ourselves not only the discovery that there are two melons, but that one melon is larger than the other melon. This requires a little further consideration. We now have had to bring in the faculty of comparison. Then we may notice that one melon is a little riper than the other melon. This may invite that we eat the riper melon first. This is further testimony about melon. Now, there are many kinds of melons in the world which we know only by the names that they carry, which we have gradually, through common experience, learned to associate with a type of melon. Therefore, we may say to ourselves, this is a watermelon. This is a cassava melon. This is a cantaloupe. And the very process of so doing seems to bestow upon us some deep and wonderful capacity to grasp the significance of melon. Actually, it does not. If our common experience had resulted in a reversal of the names, we would have used them just as glibly. There is no essential knowledge of the melon to be gained by this type of consideration. But as we look at these two melons, there are other factors that introduce themselves. Once long ago, we went by a melon patch and saw how melons grew. Looking at the melon on the table, we may gain a reminiscence, a recollection of other things about melons. We may remember that an old friend of us told once how to test a ripe one. Almost instinctively, we're going to reach over and see how these live up to expectation. We are also going to begin to think of the value of melon. If these are standing side by side in a grocery stall, We want to know that the one we are buying at a certain price is what it is described to be. We also remember that on a certain occasion we ate too many melons and got sick. We also cannot overlook the fact that we have only certain facilities for the preservation of fruit, therefore we must not load in too many melons, or our ice box or refrigerator will be overstocked. All kinds of side thoughts come up to us about melons. Now, what are these side thoughts? Are they a wise old master of melon mysteries expressing itself through our personality? Actually, it is not this at all. We are not coming to sage and wonderful individual conclusions about melons. What we are really doing is digging out of our memories what we already know about melons. And if we know nothing, nothing is going to come out. And if the information that we have in there about melons is wrong, wrong information is going to come out. If the information was reasonably correct, we suddenly have available to us in one place at one time in a coordinated form that which we subconsciously already know about melons. No more, no less. This, what we call thinking, is very largely trying to remember what we have already observed about something. It is trying to bring to bear upon our own need something that at one time occurred to another person whom we knew. This is a kind of vicarious way of thinking. Very few people use it intelligently. Then we are also calling upon our education for all kinds of facts that we gained through the years of schooling. If our schooling was poor, the facts are defective. As we go thinking along, which is largely remembering, we are apt to come to serious holes in our recollections. During the week when we were home with the chicken pox, things happened in the schoolroom that we were not there to attend. So somewhere along the way, some fragment of information that might normally have been available to us is just not available. Therefore, in the midst of a seeming knowledge about something, we find ourselves in an immediate state of ignorance. This immediately recommends some consideration or some procedure, especially if the need is immediate and urgent. Therefore, we have encyclopedias, we have dictionaries, we have neighbors, we have all kinds of resources that if all else goes bad, we can write a long letter to the Secretary of Agriculture, who is always rejoicing at such correspondence, which comes in by the ton. But we are immediately going to try to find out something, but only if that which we desire to know is involved immediately and directly in some challenging situation that seems to have some benefit for ourselves. So much for the common way in which we put together what available facts we possess. The second consideration is that we have to put together facts that are not visible, are not physical, and were not directly received through the sensory perceptions except by means of transmission. We had to use the senses to read about them, or the senses to hear someone else tell us about them. But the senses experienced only transmission, not the fact itself. When someone tells us how life is at the North Pole and we have never been there, his communication does not give us the experience that he had, but it gives us a certain transmission of common or ordinary facts which may have certain utility. So in the problem of abstract things, we are not able to depend immediately upon personal experience. So we have created great systems of learning. These systems being composed largely of specialists who devote great time and consideration to small areas of intense labor, with the conviction that only in this way can they achieve penetration. Their findings can be transmitted to other people in various degrees. But in these specialized areas, there have also arisen certain sensitivities. One of the common sensitivities of man is his prodigious overestimation of authority. I know many, many cases in which the individual is, against his own realization, swept away by the old traditional patterns within himself, which he has never been able to quite solve or modernize or escape from. Thus, a person will spend hours telling why the entire theory of authority is worthless, but he will stand humbled and abashed in the presence of the first famous person he meets. Whether the famous person knows anything or not isn't even important. It is famous. So we still all go out looking for autographs, cut buttons off of people's coats, read with tremendous avidity the scandals of popular heroes, and are deeply impressed by the mere fact that things seem famous or important. Out of fame and importance, therefore, we have developed a sensitivity. And this sensitivity causes us to become peculiarly responsive to what we term authority. Now, responsiveness in this case is merely the activity of a point of attention. If we are not convinced that the person whom we are intending to investigate is important, we have little interest in it. If we do not think his ideas are good, we do not want to bother with them. But if for one reason or another we regard him as exceptional, then we focus attention upon him, becoming more aware of him, more aware of whatever communication that he may make. And the communications of the famous are therefore etched more deeply into our subconscious memory than the communications of those for whom we have little particular respect or interest. Even the communications of those we hate are more deeply traced than those about whom we are indifferent. It follows from this that gradually we have turned over a very large part of the so-called thinking process to formularize solutions to problems. We allow our educators to determine what we need to know. We allow them to tell us when they think we are educated. They do this by conferring upon us a mortar board and a diploma. We then are convinced, not by anything we know, but by what they have told us, that we are ready to go out and seek fame and fortune. We have been given such instruction as our way of life seem to feel should be impressed upon the subconscious substances of memory. Thus, we have our education behind us. And we have it there forever, as long as we live, to be drawn upon for various attitudes, for various beliefs. If our education was highly specialized, there are some areas in which perhaps we are particularly skilled. But this is compensated for by the fact there are other areas in which we know practically nothing. Today, what we know is largely determined
by what our race, our world, our culture believes to be knowable or believes to be worth knowing. If general opinion is that a subject cannot be known, we spend little time or attention with it. If we do not believe that it is worth knowing, we are also inclined to give it scant consideration. In this way, a small group, leaders, powerful personalities in various areas become the shepherds of our destinies. They determine what we shall think and how we shall think, not by an immediate despotism of their wills, but by the type of nutrition they feed the mind during the formative years. All the time, also, that this information is being fed into us in various ways, we are also subject to another series of pressures which might be termed the response of the senses to the observed phenomena of life. We hear from educators, particularly those who have some of the old-fashioned Scottish metaphysical point of view, that the honorable man is going to succeed. But our eyes, ears, noses, and throats seem to reveal to us that the dishonest man succeeds quite admirably, and if anything, simply exploits the honest man more audaciously. So what we observe does not always agree with what we are taught. We are assured that our religion is a source of great spiritual consolation, so we receive a certain amount of it. We are not sure, however, in practice or in the testimonies of the senses, that religious people are living what they claim to believe. And just as the small boy is torn between parental advice and parental example, which may not be even consistent, man growing up finds the mental coordinator torn between the dogmatic instruction that is poured into it and the much more sprightly experiences with which it is daily confronted. This results in what might be termed divided allegiance. This divided allegiance nearly always ends in some kind of a mental dilemma, which we may call confusion. Things do not seem to work out as we expected them to, perhaps because we tried to work them out on one level while our expectations were on a different level. We are not at all happy when we estimate the quality of our achievements in the terms of the compensations with which they are rewarded. Everywhere there is confusion. And in this confusion, man is torn, usually, between theory and practice, between the old ways as he hears about them and the new ways as he sees them every day. Actually, from such a confusion, he may come to an embitterment. He may be disillusioned. He may reach that peculiar state in which he no longer believes anything. Becomes a total doubting Thomas, a skeptic, or even a cynic. Out of confusion of this kind, undoubtedly rises our agnostic and our atheist. He is not a person who has within himself a driving determination to be different or to be negative. He is simply unable to find sense in the phenomena around him. He cannot make theories and practices meet. He cannot see the justice in things which some common faculty in himself
perceives to be unjust. Thus we have the mixed mind. And out of this mixture of mind, we have again a second level of the two melons on the table. One melon is now, we will say, the code of principles which we have heard about, the great laws that have been given to us, the religions by which our lives were more anciently influenced than at the present time. Here is a wonderful structure of principles, ideals, beliefs, commendments, and commandments. This is one melon. The other melon is the life we know, the people we meet on the street, the boys and girls we went to school with, the young hot rod driver, the spoiled child, the hysterical mother, the alcoholic father, and the forever challenging circumstances of discontent and discord in personal relationships. Which of these is true? How are we going to compare one with the other? So we ultimately reach a state in which the mind itself has to choose between the acceptance of things traditionally true and the recognizing of things which are true by experience. Under such conditions, the mind, by its own very nature, having no qualitative instrument within itself, usually chooses that which is most obvious. The mind accepts experience first, for what happens to us is more real than what can happen to anyone else. What we have seen and heard is more important than what someone else tells us. Therefore, first-hand information has priority. This is one of the reasons why civilizations decline when the conducts of their people decline, and that no matter how great a minority of creative people there may be, civilization cannot survive the disintegration of the moral values of average persons. For these average persons are the perpetual examples, indoctrinating each other and often infecting each other with their common negations and delinquencies. Therefore, we now have the mind as merely something that takes hold upon obvious things, puts them through a kind of an IBM machine, sorts them out. This mind can be extremely accurate, sometimes distressingly so, but it never has any insight about anything. It comes out with the answer. The answer that is based upon all the information that has previously been fed into the machine. And sometimes, as the result of feeding in a conglomerate of information, the answer that comes out appears miraculous. It seems as though this machine was really thinking. But it is still only making use of the elaborate system that has been set up within its own mechanism, by which the mechanism records not only separate factors, but combines them according to powerful systems that we might almost consider to be mechanical logic. But in it all, there isn't a thinker anywhere in the lot. And the same is true in this mental process of arriving at decision. What we finally decide, we say, this is my conclusion. This is often passed down from the bench with great solemnity. The lawyer is assumed to have taken into consideration all factors. The judge is assumed to have the skill to determine all values and to interpret the law accurately. If you ask a judge about this, he will smile probably, and he will point out that to the degree that he is a good judge, he is an IBM machine. The moment the judge says to himself, "That poor old man down there, I'm so sorry for him, I just can hardly stand it," justice is apt to go out the window. It is, in law, a detriment to some, but a defense to many, that justice is blindfolded. Because it is not possible in any other way for something that is based entirely upon the concept of fact can function. It has to be that way. So the mental coordinator is out looking for facts. And it has very little understanding of something that might be bigger than facts. And this thing that could be bigger than fact is truth. For truth is more than putting all these elements into a machine. The truth about a thing must penetrate into the innermost nature of that thing. Truth must explain causes. Truth must examine motives. Truth must approach each person as a person and not as an equation. Truth must try to discover the hidden moral forces operating behind facts. And if we are able to discover truth, we are in the presence of something much greater than fact. But the means of the discovery of truth are very strange, curious, and abstract. Now, truth is one of the most comforting, delightful words that we have. We use it just as though it meant something. We confuse it constantly with fact, and we also confuse fact with truth. When we say to a friend of ours, "The truth of this matter is," we are really saying, "This is the way I think it is." No more. Perhaps one or two further investigations have been made. But most persons do not arrive at truth by research, but by the pressure of opinion. Truth to the individual is what he wants to believe. This is because he has ingeniously escaped from fact. Now, facts are important, but truths have to be built upon facts. You do not eliminate the fact to find the truth. You press through the fact to discover the more part of itself, that which is greater. And without the fact, the truth will be hard to discover. So in this mental process of coordination, truth becomes a kind of overtone. Truth is something that seems to emerge from certain other sources within ourselves, sources beside those which we most commonly use. Suppose we should now exchange our two melons for two very beautiful bowls, one of white porcelain and the other perhaps of glorious green celadon. These are exquisite bowls. They're standing side by side on the table. Both are works of art. So you say to a man, "Which is the more beautiful of the two?" You'll say, "That one." Why? Is it really better? No.
You will say to another man, which do you like the best? And he will point out the other one. And you might tell these two men that they are not in agreement. The man who likes the white bowl will say that the man who likes the celadon is just simply inexperienced, childish, hasn't any real taste at all. The other chap, if he is not very charitable, will say the same thing. Each will be convinced that his own taste is impeccable, and the other person's highly nondescript. You can't alter this. But why does it occur? Why do we have other factors coming into this situation by which, when we have facts, we are inevitably impelled to take sides about them? We cannot leave facts alone. No one has ever been able to. We must begin to create fields of overtones around these facts. And one of the areas in which we create these overtones is that we place ourselves in some relationship to the fact. Is this fact helpful to me? Is this fact the fact I want? If it is, there is a certain exhilaration, there is a certain appreciation, there is a certain ready recognition. But if this fact comes up with an answer that is totally contrary to my own wishes and desires, I will probably have an engineer in to go over the machine. The machine must be wrong. The individual himself couldn't be wrong. And even if the machine is proved to be in good running order, the individual who does not like the fact that he learns will find one way or another to separate himself from the acceptance of it. Thus we learn that in the course of existence, in the course of living, in the course of building up the various conditions that we know, we have a number of recollections or reminiscences or association mechanisms which have a tendency to interfere with the clear statement of conclusion. We find that with every decision that we make, every situation that arises, that we remember things that were pleasant and unpleasant, fortunate or unfortunate. And these things add their evidence in the weighing of the so-called objective fact to the simple processes of this IBM procedure, therefore. We add certain experiences at large, experiences that float around and will arise under many conditions and in very strange patterns, experiences which cause us to reject or cause us to question or cause us to exploit the so-called facts, not just to recognize them and go on with them. If man was an unconditioned creature, he could live by unconditioned facts and would be the most dull instrument the nation ever produced, because there is something very dead and sterile about facts. It is difficult to get up and work into a state of enthusiasm on the fact that rains fall or that the tides ebb and flow. These things perhaps can be made into something of significance by the poet, but in the daily experience of living, facts by themselves are not meaningful. Facts are only challenges by which we must come to some extended opinion or conclusion within ourselves. Facts mean what they mean to us. And because we do not have any clear center by which meaning is assured, we go on our grand old way of endless speculation, endless opinion,
and continuous conflict with others about the validity of ideas. There is no answer to this in the world as we know it today. There are points in this procedure that have interest to us in our daily living, in the problems that we must all encounter. I think the most important basic lesson is that the study of the mind reveals to us that we simply cannot afford to be pig-headed. We cannot afford to assume that we are always right. We cannot afford to assume that our own thoughts are always important. And we have no right to assume that we really like the things we say we like, or really do not like the things we say we do not like. All of these conclusions arise from a set of factors that are not dependable. We can only assume that at any given moment our thinking is the substance of our attainment. If we have attained much, perhaps our thinking is worth more. If we have attained little, our thinking is worth little. This would be a wonderful way to relieve the world of one of the heaviest plagues with which it is afflicted, egotists. The egotist is the person who has overwhelmingly abdicated in favor of the infallibility of his own mind. He is convinced that this mind is always right because it is his, and that other people's minds are no better than they should be, but his is far better than it could ever hope to be. The egotist is not always a terrible monster, although occasionally we do produce monstrosities in this area. The average egotist is simply a comparatively ignorant person who doesn't know it, who in one way or another has built defenses against realities, has tried desperately to achieve some form of status, who is desperately desirous of being heard, of being appreciated, of being respected, of being admired, without very many basic qualifications. Thus he must advance himself. He must be his own press agent. He must try to impress other people. And he usually finally impresses them with his own ignorance. But perhaps they do not wait to tell him, and he goes happily on his way. But egotism in every department of life is dangerous to clear thinking and to the solution of any of the essential problems of living. There is one wonderful thing we can all do, and that is relax and suspect that there are things that we should know that we do not know, and that we are not going to pass final judgment on anything or anyone until we know more than we know now. This is tremendously helpful in arbitrating what might otherwise be violent head-on collisions. And the worst part of it is there are so many martyrs to these collisions who have died because they thought they were right and they were never right in the first place. We find this true in many different theories of life. We find it true in politics. We find it true in the arts and sciences, where tremendous patterns of opinion have gradually taken over, and individuals are convinced, each in his own case, that his group, his side, his faction is completely right. The other person is completely wrong. This is never more evident than at election time, when people who know none of the candidates become violently upset over the vices and virtues of people they've never met and about whom they know nothing except what appears in a highly prejudiced press. The mental coordinator is best served by the individual gradually supplying it with additional information, knowing that we must depend upon judgment for most of the decisions of life. It becomes important that this judgment shall be as sound, as adequate, as enlightened as possible. Into the mind, which is going to be this coordinator, therefore, we must also cause to flow interesting and valuable information bearing upon problems where thinking is necessary and proper. We must educate the coordinator. This only means that we must provide it with more material upon which to arrive at conclusion. Perhaps our problem calls for a larger IBM circuit than we have. We had the $25,000 machine, but suddenly it looks as though we needed the $190,000 machine. We find that the smaller machine will not do some of the things that the larger machine will do. On the same ground, small minds cannot accomplish what large minds can accomplish. Only answer to this is enlarge the mind. Get more information into the coordinator so that it is able to bring better testimony. Now, the coordinator is able to react to a number of different levels of information. The idealist contributes something to the coordinator. The coordinator's reactions are a little more subtle, a little more gentle, a little more kindly, and a little more penetrating if the individual has been feeding insight into the machine. This doesn't mean the machine has insight, but it means that a new equation is introduced into the large problem. The person who suddenly has strong religious conviction also feeds into the mental coordinator certain moral and spiritual convictions. If these are deeply and truly held, then all judgments by the coordinator must include these equations. They must be part of this pattern. So a man who has had 9 experiences in life, and these are fed into the coordinator, is not quite as able as the man who has had 100 experiences in life. The individual who has lived superficially on the surface of existence from the cradle to the grave can only feed into the coordinator from the level of his own superficial experience. It is useless to think that the individual is shallow on the outside and deep on the inside. This is just not true. He will never be any shallower on the inside than we observe. He will never be any deeper on the outside than the inside can provide. And when he is deeper inside, the outside automatically changes and meets this new situation. So there cannot be a great interval in which an individual is a physical failure in everything, but a great spiritual success at the same time. The individual cannot be always right and always miserable, nor can he be always wrong and always happy. The coordinator must be adjusted.